We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me again this week. Now, at present, I'm currently getting ready for a series of podcast episodes I'm going to bring you soon called The Summer of Psycho. Some of you will have seen me discuss this already on social media, but if you didn't, I can tell you that The Summer of Psycho is going to involve 8 individual podcasts, all themed around the classic Alfred Hitchcock film, which reaches its 60th anniversary later this year. So, because I'm tied up preparing and recording for The Summer of Psycho, I don't have a brand new episode to bring you this week. Instead, I thought it would be fun to air a rerun of one of our older Hitchcock podcasts. What you're going to hear today is a discussion from October 2018, when I was joined by Brandon Shea Mutala to discuss 1943's Shadow of a Doubt, starring Joseph Cotten and Theresa Wright. I know we've had quite a big increase in listeners since this first aired, so hopefully many of you won't have heard this episode before. I began by asking Brandon to tell me about his work on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast.
What originally happened is a friend of mine, who I met through a board gaming group here in Regina, his name's Tom Caldwell, and he had like a movie night that he had at his house every once in a while, and I was never able to make it to it, like just the nights that he had it and having young kids. But he frequently had Hitchcock movie nights, and I'm like, you know, I love Hitchcock so much, but most of his movies I'd only seen once, and I hadn't seen them in a very long time. So I talked to him one day, and I said, do you want to start this podcast? So him and I did. And while we were trying to find a place to host our podcast, Tony Black, put us in touch with our other co-host, Chris Haig. And he said, this is a person who really likes Hitchcock as well. So he's out where you are over in England there. And so the three of us podcast, we have a monthly podcast, it's just once a month, and we're going through the Hitchcock films one at a time. And we've had a few interviews here and there along the way. We've made it through all of his silent films now. We haven't recorded it yet. We'll be recording it next Monday as of this recording, but our next film is going to be Rich and Strange. And it's been a lot of fun going through them. I had thought that I'd seen all of his movies, but I didn't remember most of the silent films. And a couple of his early talkie films I hadn't seen either. So I know now I've seen all of his movies, but, you know, again, a lot of them I'd only seen once. And the one we're going to talk about today, I don't think I've seen in 15 years, right? So
that's one of the things I find quite valuable about your podcast, actually, is I'm very familiar with Hitchcock stuff kind of post 1940, and I've seen a few of the earlier films then, but not all of them by any means. So yeah, I like what you guys are doing. I like the fact it's quite leisurely, and you're not in any hurry, are you, to get to like Psycho and stuff like that? You're really taking your time. That's one thing I like.
We want to get to Psycho really quickly, but yeah, we tried a few things along the way. We're like, well, what if we do this and this and this, but we haven't really had the time. Like, I wanted to do, you know, like the remakes of films and stuff as well. I'm like, yeah, let's do all the remakes of this. And I just don't have the time. I'm so busy with my other podcasts. But our last episode was an interview with the people whose dogs were used as Hitchcock's dogs in the, I think it was the Anthony Hopkins biopic. So we just talked a little bit, because those type of dogs are Hitchcock's favorite type of dogs. And so we've had a few little things in there. That was kind of a filler, because we've all been busy over summer here, so.
Yeah, speaking of remakes, I only realized recently that Shadow of a Doubt has had a kind of a TV movie remake, hasn't it? I haven't seen it, though.
But anyway. Neither have I, yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the man himself, then, Alfred Hitchcock. This is the first Hitchcock film I'm doing on this podcast. I think he's one of those directors that, you know, sooner or later he was going to come up with something like this. What do you think, if you could kind of summarize it, is so great about him?
I think the main reason is he was like the first celebrity director. He was the first director that people knew who he was. They could put a face to the name. And he had this persona, you know, this dry British humor, you know, and all of his jokes are about like death and murder and, you know, bringing murder to its proper place, which is in the home, you know, things like this, right? It was this very interesting persona that he crafted and created for himself so that people would know who he was. And that really influenced the type of films that he created, I believe. And having that type of persona, you know, kind of guided him along on his path and helped him to choose the type of products that he would put out there for the audience. And I think that's really what makes him so unique as a director. But then also, like, his TV show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and having himself on the front and center every week and you know, just keeping that personality alive and in the audience, you know, in the audience's vision and the audience's consciousness.
Yeah, he's a very interesting figure in that sense, isn't he? He's a self-publicist, mm-hmm. you know, a very skillful self-publicist, a director as a star, really. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, I think of him as one of England's great, you know, exports to American cinema, really. I'd put him up there with, you know, if I was listing England's great contributors to film, I'd put Hitchcock up there with someone like Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. you know. I suppose another kind of famous, you know, a director that people knew, but of course Chaplin had the on-screen presence that Hitchcock didn't in terms of starring roles and stuff like that.
Who's that? Who's Charlie Chaplin?
Yeah, well, he's this little-known figure. Yeah, he's just kind kidding. Of faded from... Yeah. I think the thing with Hitchcock... One of the many things I'd say I find so fascinating about him is he's clearly got this dark side, mm-hmm. you know, and so his films are so interesting to me because he seems to be kind of engaging with his, like, personal obsessions and neuroses and fears through his films, really. So you get all these recurring, like, motifs running through them, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but that's from a kind of contemporary perspective, I suppose, where we've had years and years of, like, dedicated analysis to Hitchcock through documentaries and books and so on. I think round about the time this film was made, maybe the debate would have been a bit more around, like, is he really an artist or is he a great entertainer, you know? I think in that respect, the tide of history has kind of turned in his favor. Do you know what I mean? Where he's given great respect, of course, these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would consider him to be one of the great artists as well. Yeah. Like, he's a great director. But I would put him along the same categories as somebody like James Cameron, who's a person who's always trying to advance the medium, trying to see what they can do, or a Steven Soderbergh, where they're always playing with the medium and trying to see what they can do. And he's one of those people who I just wish would be alive now just to see what they would be doing with the technology, you know, because he was always trying to provoke that, you know, movies like Rope. Like, Rope is my favorite Hitchcock film. And in this, a lot of people think it's cheesy, but I think it's really interesting in that he was trying to make a movie in one take. And he couldn't because of the limitations of the medium. So what he did was he would do like 8 or 10 minute takes, whatever the length of the roll of film was. And if he made a mistake, they would start again. And then they would hide the edits by moving the camera all around the stage and then hiding it in like close-ups of people's backs and stuff like that. So he's somebody that I would love to have seen what he could have done more with 3D. I mean, he only made the one 3D film, but with modern 3D, surround sound, like the kind of technology he would have loved to be playing with, I think.
No, I think you're definitely right, because like with Dial M for Murder, it's sort of so fascinating because it comes right at the end of like the 3D craze in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, you know, he gave it his utmost attention, I think, and he was really like alive to the possibilities like it offered. So no, I think that's extremely true. Is he like an unassailable figure? I mean, are there criticisms of his work that you think are valid? And I mean, I'm thinking of a couple of things, really. I mean, obviously, I don't know if you guys have got into this at all in your podcast yet. I mean, you haven't really got to the films yet, but I'm thinking of things like, I think Tippi Hedren spoken about some of his on-set treatment and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I suppose examining him through a modern lens, does it pose certain challenges, do you think?
I think that it does. And while, you know, I know the stories of, you know, like sexual harassment claims and stuff like this. I haven't researched myself too much yet. We're not quite there yet. I mean, if this is a person who's done it later in life, he probably did it his whole time on the sets. But I mean, it's challenging and it's difficult to look at things through the past, you know, through a lens right now, because while we don't accept things and they shouldn't have been accepted at the time, it's like, do we dismiss somebody's work because of their personality? You know, like, there's a lot of people like that. Like, I look at what happened with Kevin Spacey in a show like House of Cards, and, you know, I compare that as well to somebody like Roseanne and what happened with her. And it's like, okay, so what they've done is bad. But, I mean, like, is what happened to them proper justification for what happened? I'm not the person to answer that question. But, I mean, like, I read an interesting article about what happened with Bill Cosby. And it's like, you know, Bill Cosby had his own issues, but it's like the Cosby Show was a very important show for a lot of people. So if people were to just wipe this show from existence, like, you know, that's almost a crime because it's an important show. You know, so it's like it's really a fine dance that I don't have the answers for, but it's very good to talk about because it's important to not lose sight of everything that's involved in it, you know. So I hope that kind of makes sense.
It does. And you're right. It's a hard one to talk around, especially when, you know, it's not the main focus like here. We're just kind of brushing past it. But I suppose with Hitchcock, you know, one thing is that because he's long gone, it means a couple of things. It means you can't, you know, it's very difficult to substantiate things that are said about him now. And I think also people engage differently with stories like this when they're about people who are long dead. I suspect they do anyway, you know. So it's a tough one. It's a tough one. And, you know, it's one that maybe, like if I ever did a podcast on the birds, for example, it might be what, or Marnie, you know, it'd be something that would be like integral to that discussion, I suppose. All right, then, Shadow of a Doubt. So I'll just let me just fill you in on why I wanted to do this Hitchcock film first, really, and it's for a couple of reasons. I mean, I'm sort of thinking, hopefully, this podcast can go for a long time, so in that sense, there's no need for me to, like, rush to be covering, like, North by Northwest and Vertigo and Psycho and whatever. So I was sort of thinking, you know, playing a long game here. But aside from that, I think Shadow of a Doubt's a fascinating one to begin with. It's a film I hold in high regard, and it's one I hadn't seen for a long time, so, you know, doing it for the podcast was a great excuse to kind of dig the DVD out, basically. Before we get on to, like, our feelings on the film, what's your sense of, like, where people generally kind of put this one in Hitchcock's body of work? Have you got any kind of... Where do you feel people kind of put this one, generally?
Well, going into this movie, and from what I know about Hitchcock, like, I'm not a Hitchcock scholar by any means. Like, I'm researching as I go, and I'm learning about his career as I go along, and we haven't hit this film yet. But I would say, honestly, from what I know, this wouldn't be one that's really highly regarded because I don't find it talked about a lot. It's not one of those ones that people list as his greats. You know, you don't really see it on lists. And even when I saw it, I mean, I didn't remember a single thing of this film. So, you know, it's been quite a long time. It's been probably 12 or 15 years since I've seen this. But even there, I don't remember it making that much of an impact on me in my early 20s. So I would have to say that my initial impression is that this is not one of his more well-regarded films. However, the DVD that I have, I didn't get a chance to watch it, had a bonus feature that said that this is Hitchcock's favorite film.
Yeah, this is something people always bring up, and like I tweeted I was going to be watching this film, and a few people said that to me, oh, that's Hitchcock's favourite film. Now, I've got the book, Hitchcock Truffaut. I don't know if you've read that, Brandon, or not.
I haven't. One of my co-hosts has it, but I haven't got to that yet. I've listened to some of the interviews,
yeah,
right? And again, I've only listened as far as the shows that we've covered, right? So
It's a really great read. I highly recommend it. And I think Truffaut says to Hitchcock, is this your favourite of your own films? Mm-hmm. And Hitchcock said, no, I never said that.
Ah.
And he said, if I did say that, he says, or something along those lines, if I did say it, it's because there's nothing in this film that people can kind of take issue with in terms of logic. So I thought, okay. And then I watched the film and I read a few reviews around it. And one of the things I read was Roger Ebert's review of the film, where he put it in his Great Movies feature that he did. And Ebert spends a couple of paragraphs just kind of taking, kind of deconstructing that statement, really, and poking all the holes in the film. You could, if you're doing a literal kind of plot reading of it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my sense is this, that I think people are really into Hitchcock like this one, but I think if you stop people on the street, you know, and said, like, name a bunch of Alfred Hitchcock films, I think it'd be very rare that this one came up. You'd be hearing things like Psycho, wouldn't you, The Birds, Rear Window, I guess. I mean, one crude measure of it is the IMDb, which I normally don't spend that much time on, but I had a quick look on there, the Internet Movie Database. I mean, where would you guess this one ranks if you just kind of line up Hitchcock's films in order of user rating?
Well, okay, so let's just use... If I had to use the XCast as a gauge, right? Because that's honestly the only time I ever hear IMDb ratings is when we're on the XCast together there, or the new Time Is Now podcast. I'd have to say that this would probably get a 7 on IMDb.
No, you're selling it short a bit, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Well, 7.9 is what it gets.
7.9, okay.
And it's 11th from all the Hitchcock films.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's in between. The Lady Vanishes is 10th, and The 39 Steps is 12th. Shadow of a Doubt is ahead of stuff like The Birds, To Catch a Thief, The Wrong Man. So it pretty good. I think it's doing pretty well over there.
I would say Lady Vanishes is definitely better than this movie.
Well, what would you reckon? I really like this one, but we'll get onto that. But what do you reckon are the top rated Hitchcock films? What do you reckon people go for?
Right at the top, I would have to say Psycho, Vertigo, and North by Northwest are probably the top three.
Well, the top three are Psycho is number one, 8.5, which I thought it'd be higher.
Mm-hmm.
Rear Window also is 8.5. That's number two, and Vertigo is 8.3 in third. So yeah, those you know, what else did you say? North by Northwest,
Northwest
is fourth.
Fourth, yeah. Okay, so I would get a prize at least, right? So
yeah, you're doing well.
Ding ding ding.
So no, I think it's pretty highly regarded. If not, you know. Yeah, I think a lot of people maybe wouldn't list it as quintessential Hitchcock. Like I say, maybe there's a general lack of awareness about this one, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see. So you said like this is one you hadn't seen for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same for me. I mean, I remember when I was getting into Hitchcock a bit, it was about 15 years ago or so, there was something called the Hitchcock Collection that was being released on DVD over here, but I couldn't afford the whole box set, so I was buying them singly. So I think I'd gone through all those films we talked about, like Psycho, and eventually I got The Shadow of a Doubt. Probably seen it a couple of times over the years, but it has been a while. I mean, so what did you think about it this time in general? Did your opinion of it go up? I mean, you said you couldn't remember much about it, did you? So
I don't know what I thought of it. This time, though, I was pretty blown away with it. Like, it was really, really good. And, you know, without giving away too many opinions on the characters and the plots and stuff like this, like, I was actually pretty blown away with this film. It's very... I was looking for it. There's nothing really in this film that screams Hitchcock to me, you know? So I found that kind of interesting as I was watching it, but it was still a really well-done movie. Like, I don't know, when do you want to do the ratings? Do you do them early, or do you do them later in the podcast?
Well, you can do it now if you want to. Yeah, what would you rate it if you're doing so?
So I gave this a 4.5 out of 5 on my Letterboxd reviews here. You know, there was a couple of little things, just tiny nitpicky things that I think keep it from being a 5, but I mean, like, it was really, really well done. Like, Joseph Cotten in this film, I hate his guts. What a terrible person, you know? And that's awesome. Yeah. That's great. You know, he did such a wonderful job. Like, he hit a home run with this movie. Like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be honest. This is one of my favorite Hitchcock films. I mean, if I was listing a few of my favorites, it would be Psycho, Strangers on the Train, and Shadow of a Doubt, I think. I really, really like it. I think it's tremendous. I think one reason is, and we'll get more into this, but I do tend to enjoy films that take a bit of like a jaundiced look at small town life, you know, small town America. And I think he does that extremely well here. Like you said, great performances. I think Teresa Wright's really good too. And I find like the connections between the two Charlies fascinating. Again, we'll break it down a bit. There's some really weird things going on in the margins of this film that I've been thinking about them a lot since I've just rewatched it, but things I hadn't really picked up on before. So, yeah, this is a great film in my opinion. I think the central characters are so compelling. I think the treatment of the small town setting feels kind of authentic, but ultimately very disturbing. And that's kind of what I respond to, really. So, yeah, maybe the small town thing. In terms of plot breakdown and stuff, I'm going to assume that people watching or people listening to the podcast have probably seen the film.
Yes, you better have seen the film.
Yeah, so we might jump around from here to there. But please stop and go and watch it if you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Small town America. What grabbed you about Hitchcock's treatment of it here?
One of the things that really stuck out to me was kind of the interaction that the characters had with some of the lesser characters in it. Like, for example, when the girl Charlie was out on the date with that guy, and she didn't know he was an investigator at the time, and she got caught in her lie of saying she wasn't feeling well. Like, that whole, the subtext there, like, you can totally see that the subtext is just dripping from that scene, you know. But also, the interaction that she had with that lady that was working at the telegraph station, you know, like, that's such a interesting little interaction, you know, and this her father and his friend, like this boring couple of guys that just like to sit and chat and talk. You know, I thought it was interesting, and they had this stuff littered throughout the film, and I'm like, I didn't look into seeing who wrote this or whatnot, like who wrote the screenplay for this or what if it was based on a book or anything like this. But there was lots of really interesting stuff here, and the way that he presented life in this town was really well done. One of the other things that I really liked was the family life right at the beginning, you know, when everybody's like talking over top of each other. I have never seen that in a movie before, you know, or at least not to this extreme. Like, and it was really neat and cool because that's how kids are, you know, like they talk over and they interrupt and things like that.
Yeah, I guess it serves the purpose of kind of adding to a sense of like naturalism, I guess. In terms of what you were saying about who wrote it, it's actually quite an interesting one in that respect, because one of the writers on this film was Thornton Wilder, the playwright. I don't know if you're familiar with him. I mean, I'm only familiar with him by reputation, but he wrote stuff like The Bridge of San Luis Rey and Our Town, which I think is a play that's kind of regarded as an ode to small town life.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it, but I don't know it. I don't know the story.
Same here, but in the Hitchcock-Truffaut book I mentioned, Hitchcock talks about Wilder, and he seems kind of like in awe of his talent, really. So I don't know if you noticed, but he gets a special kind of thank you message on the opening credits where it says, like, thank you to Thornton Wilder for his excellent participation or something like that. He wasn't the only writer on the film, though. I think Hitchcock's wife, Alma Reveal, gets a credit too, and somebody called Sally Benson. What I was going to say, I mean, even before we get to the small town, what I like is like this sense of like the city that you get when you see Charlie early on. Just those opening shots, really. So you see all sorts of stuff like wrecked cars and stuff like that. So you get the sense that the city is this kind of wasteland or something, you know. Charlie's like this decadent figure because he's led on the bed with all this money around him. So then when you get to like this idyllic, like small town, he's kind of an unsettling element, isn't he? He kind of comes in and shakes things up, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And going back to what you were saying about the figures in the town, that something that struck me too. I was thinking of like the traffic policeman, who's like a really, you know, conscientious, he seems like nice, but you know, kind of firm when he perceives something is wrong, you know. And one of the things I read on this film, there's a book on Hitchcock by somebody called Robin Wood, and he compares the film to Blue Velvet, Lynch's film. Have you seen Blue Velvet?
I haven't seen Blue Velvet, no.
Oh, very, very disturbing. I think what he's saying here is like, in Lynch's film, the small town values are kind of poked fun at, you know. So there's like a fireman at the start of Blue Velvet who seems really ridiculous. But in Hitchcock's film, I think he really does get across like the appeal of such towns. Do you know what I mean? He didn't feel like he was being too ironic in his treatment of this setting, really. Mm-hmm.
See, the thing is, though, that this doesn't strike me as a small town. Like, it's bustling. Like, there's lots of people everywhere. I mean, for this being a small town, like, just on a weeknight, this library's open until 9 o'clock. You know, like the small town that I lived in La Ronge, Saskatchewan, had 5,000 people. And, like, you know, the library's closing at 5 o'clock Monday to Friday. You know, things are open late and, you know, they're closed on Sundays and Mondays, things like that. And, you know, to have a traffic cop there, to have enough traffic that you need a person there guiding people across the street. So it's like interesting that they consider this a small town and a look at small town life when this doesn't seem to be a small town at all.
That's an interesting take on that. You're right, though. The streets are quite bustling and there are always like loads of people crossing the road and stuff like that, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, to further the Lynch comparison, if you think of something like Twin Peaks, that is a much, you know, evidently a much smaller town in that series and film, you know. So, yeah, I think that's a fair point.
Well, Twin Peaks itself, too, is not a small town. I mean, like, they're trying to give this impression that it's a small town, but, I mean, like, something like the Bang Bang, like, what's the bar? That would never fly in a small town, like, that kind of music and whatnot. Like, that's...
Yeah.
That place is shutting down on day one, like...
Well, there's a story in Twin Peaks where the Welcome to Twin Peaks sign that you see at the start of the series in the credits, it says 51,201 or something like that. And supposedly the story is the network insisted that they wanted a 5,201. The network insisted that, you know, people wouldn't be able to relate to a town with such a small population, so you've got to go back in and change it, I think, is the story. In terms of Shadow of a Doubt, I really liked... In terms of the sense of, like, you know, the difference between what's going on the surface in this town and what's really going on, I think one of Charlie's speeches kind of hits at it, where he says, like, Do you know the world is a foul sty? Do you know if you rip off the fronts of houses, you'd find swine? The world's a hell. What does it matter what happens in it? Wake up, Charlie. All that stuff. That's really interesting, actually. The way it kind of gives voice to Charlie's kind of viewpoint is quite terrifying, really. But I'm glad they kind of went there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. And that's one of the things where that led to one of the parts where it just kind of didn't work for me, in that he was trying to hide from this crimes that he's done. But, you know, when he's sitting there at the dinner table at that one meal and he's talking about these wives dead with dead husbands and their money, and he's like calling them, like, you know, what, I can't even remember what he called them, cattle or whatever. Like,
that's something like that, yeah.
And it's like he's sitting there in the middle of this talking this way. It just seemed a little bit too much. Like, it works in the film because it makes you dislike this character so much, but it's just like, to talk like this with Charlie suspecting him already, it's like, I don't know, like, it just didn't seem quite right. I'm like, that's a little too much for me, you know? So.
Yeah, well, it's true, because early on in the film, he's much more, you know, making an effort to fit in, isn't he? And I think what's good about his performance is, like, it gives us just enough to, like, understand why he's so well-liked by the family. So I'm thinking of that scene where he, like, flourishes the gifts for everyone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You really, at that moment, you really see his charisma, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, at other times, he's just absolutely terrifying. Yeah, so when he's going on about useless women and these silly wives and so on.
The one that was the most terrifying for me with him was when he was eating breakfast in bed, you know, talking to his sister. And you could hear his voice. He was so pleasant in the way that he was talking and the words that he was choosing. But his face, he was like angry and upset. And I was like, oh my goodness, this guy.
What about, I mean, we'll come on to talk about the relationship between the two Charlies, but let's focus on young Charlie, I suppose, Teresa Wright's character. I thought she was excellent, I really did. It kind of goes back to, you know, what we're saying about this film portrayal of small-town life, or quote-unquote small-town life. If she wasn't so effective in that role, I think, you know, her kind of innocence could be a bit grating or something, it could come across as ridiculous, but... Yeah, I never felt that Hitchcock was poking fun at her. I never felt like she was presented, like, ironically. And that kind of adds to the film, I think. It makes it even more disturbing.
I thought she was really well done, as, you know, like you're saying. I think she did a great job. You know, she's this... It's this interesting, happy little family life that you associate with this period of time, right? But she loves her uncle so much, and she's got so much adoration for uncle. There's no way that he's poking fun at her at all. This is just definite... you know, childlike exuberance that she has for this uncle who she's named after, who's a very important figure in her family's life and who turns out to be not who they thought he was.
And it's interesting in terms of other Hitchcock films. I mean, one of the motifs that's always kind of tossed around is like the Hitchcock blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he typically presented blonde women was, you know, as quite exoticized, you know, glamorous figures, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting here you have a brunette. And I think, yeah, if you'd have had a typical Hitchcock treatment, if it had been a blonde in the lead role, it might have possibly detracted away from the authenticity of it. I mean, I'm not saying that blonde women can't live in towns like this. I'm just saying the way Hitchcock typically handled those kind of women, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, so when I said that there were things in this film I'd kind of forgotten about, I mean, one of them is... it almost suggests there's this, like, telepathic link between the two Charlies, isn't it? Did you pick up on that?
Absolutely, because, you know, like, the first one could just be brushed off as, like, writing and whatnot. But when he comes off the train and she's like, oh, I thought you were sick, you're like, okay, what are they going? Where are they going with this? What is this? This is interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's break it down. So just in case people didn't notice this or didn't kind of perceive it. So... there's this duality between the two of them running all through the film. So they got the same name, obviously. In other ways, they're complete opposites, aren't they? She's this innocent figure. He very clearly isn't, you know. But when they're introduced, they're kind of mirrored. There's those two bed scenes, isn't there? You know, the first one with Charlie, he's kind of stretched out with his head to the right of the screen. And then when we first see her, she's also led on her bed. Her head's kind of on the other side of the screen, her left. So they're kind of mirrored there. And then it's like you were saying, this thing where they're kind of thinking about each other at the same time, you know. So she goes to send him a telegram.
Mm-hmm.
She finds a telegram from him waiting for her. He's the Merry Widow murderer, and she whistles the Merry Widow waltz, and he kind of knocks over the glass or something, doesn't he, to kind of Stop Her Making the Connection.
Okay, they needed to make that more clear because I did not know that song.
Yeah, I think it's because the song is not so well known now. I guess for audiences at the time, you know, it might have been well known and people would have made the link, I guess. Because he spills the glass when she says the Mary, you know, and then he doesn't want to go through with it. I mean, this aspect of the film we're talking about, though, I mean, I really enjoy it. I think if it had been any more overt, it might have become less effective and it would have tipped the film over into being something else. But kind of what they did do with it was really enjoyable, I thought. It's kind of uncanny, you know.
Yeah, I was wondering if they were going to take this somewhere strange and whatnot. But, I mean, like, him, they had a weird relationship as it was, you know, like the way that he talked to her and whatnot. Like, I don't know watching these films, and that's the interesting thing going back, and we talk about this on our Good Evening podcast frequently, is like these type of interactions are odd. And I mean, like, it, there was almost, and it seemed like there was like a romantic subtext going on between this guy and his niece, and like the way that they were talking to each other. Did you pick that up, or am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy. I was going to bring this up, and I was wondering if you'd have heard this take, because I've heard other people make this argument too. So, yeah, the suggestion of incest, basically. And I'm not saying that incest is actually happening in the narrative as such, because I don't think it is.
I agree. Yeah.
Maybe there's like a repressed incest theme going on, which obviously at the time you couldn't really express explicitly. You can hint at it, but you can suggest it through like images and motifs and so on. So yeah, I was going to give you this take that I've read in a book somewhere. So again, it's the Robin Wood Hitchcock book.
Okay.
I like the argument. Let's see what you think. Yeah, so the idea is that its sexuality is one of the main factors, really, that's kind of cracking open this small town facade or whatever. So we've talked about the mirroring of their introductions with the bedroom scenes. So what they do then is immediately associate the two characters with a bedroom, first of all. The uncle is introduced holding a cigar, so if you're on the lookout for like phallic imagery or whatever, you could easily latch onto that. The way it's shot when they first meet, or when they reunite, you could imagine that scene being, if you didn't know the story, you could imagine those were lovers reuniting. Also, he's hunched, isn't he, when he gets off the train? He's playing sick, so he can't, when he stands upright when he sees Charlie, you know, he's kind of becoming erect, if you will. So it depends how much you think Hitchcock would be willing to play with these things symbolically, I guess. Because another one would be when he goes into her bedroom, he's taking over the bedroom, isn't he? So he plucks a rose from her vase, you know, so connotations of like deflowering, right? And the ring, I mean, the ring he puts on a finger, so, you know, associations with engagement and stuff like that.
I was thinking that as soon as he put the ring, I'm like, especially with the tone, I'm like, wow.
And like you say, some of the dialogue, the way they speak about each other, so I suppose one of the questions would be, with what you know about Hitchcock, do you think he may have been consciously suggesting these things, or do you think we're kind of reaching at something that isn't really there? What do you think?
In my opinion, no. This is Hitchcock, and I think that, like, this is definitely something that he intended to put in the film.
Because there's another facet to this incest theme, you know, which is, like, between Uncle Charlie and Emmy, you know, his sister, is, again, when they reunite, I think it's not at a train station because she stayed at home, but it's when they meet at the house. Again, if you look at it, it's kind of like lovers reuniting, and he talks about her used to be the prettiest girl on the block and stuff like that. And also there's some really charged scenes between the two of them, like the second mealtime sequence. I think it's the one you were talking about where eventually Charlie goes into the thing about the widows.
Mm-hmm.
But early on in that scene, they're kind of talking across the table at each other, kind of laughing merrily away, and the husband, like, is kind of being overlooked, you know.
Yeah, and he's looking weird, like, he's like, oh.
Yeah, he's clearly not very comfortable with it, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And also, then, when she gets the news of Charlie's departure, you know, before he gets on that train at the end, like, she's kind of crestfallen, isn't she, as well?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a kiss on the lips, I think, in that scene, too. So, again, when I said there were things going on in this film that I'd never, didn't remember, and hadn't considered before, this was one of them, really, so I think, I'm like you, I think Hitchcock was playing with these ideas, and I think he's kind of, I think he probably got a kick out of suggesting them as far as he could without kind of, there's always a level of plausible deniability, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
But I mean, like, if they're like, if you got things like North by Northwest, where the last symbol of the train is supposed to symbolize intercourse, then, you know, like, that's just one thing, like, this is too much, like, this is too much in one film for it to not be intentional. I think.
Yeah, I wonder if it's something that, I wonder how many viewers would have been alive to it. Do you know what I mean? Because maybe it's something like you say, with the weight of analysis of Hitchcock's work that's come after, maybe we're kind of a bit more primed for it, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's definitely, I think it's definitely there, the tone of it is definitely there to create more unease with this character. Because when we first kind of meet him, he is very charming, right?
Yeah.
And so it's, I think a lot of it is meant to add to the unease of how we feel with the male Charlie character.
I mean, I was wondering with him whether there's almost a suggestion there's like a vague, very, very vague. I'm not going to push this one too far, but like almost a supernatural air to him in that, you know, at the beginning of the film, when he escapes or when he flees, you know, he walks past those detectives, doesn't he? He seems to get away very easily. Like we get that great overhead shot where they kind of lose track of him really easily. And then I suppose the second thing I'd point to is, you know, that scene in the garage where, you know, he set it up
when
he's trying
shuts
to kill
the door.
Exactly, but the door shuts. We don't know if he's there at the time. It's almost like the door's closed of its own volition. Obviously he could just be off screen doing it, you know. So there's some really odd little things going on just like in the margins of this film. Do you know what I mean? And they all come together to add to it, I think, rather than take anything away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if you take our reading, or maybe not our reading, but this reading that it's about, you know, sexual desire and so on. You get that character of Jack Graham, don't you? The guy played by MacDonald Carey. He's kind of the love interest, the detective and so on. I mean, first of all, I thought those two actors played off each other well. I mean, I really, you know, I felt their relationship was very believable and so on. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. They were very good. I wasn't, again, going into the film, not remembering, I wasn't sure. I originally thought that they were criminal associates, you know, maybe caught, maybe Charlie owed them money or something like this, and they were sent to kill him, you know. So I wasn't quite sure what was going on and where these characters would go. And so it was really interesting when I found out that they were detectives investigating this case, because we didn't know what was going on for half the film, I would say. Half the film, we didn't know why these people were looking for him.
Yeah. I think what I was going to drive at was like, if you read a sexual interest between the two Charlies into the film, so then he becomes almost a rival of sorts, doesn't he, for Uncle mm-hmm. Charlie? And it becomes a kind of strange sort of love triangle, mm-hmm. I guess. What about some of these other characters then? One of the criticisms I've heard is that the parents seem a bit too old to have such young children. Did you think that?
Yes, I did. I'm like, that girl and that boy are pretty darn young. Like, she's well into her 50s, this actress, I'm pretty sure. Like, unless I'm badly judging her age, they're both probably in their 50s. And that boy is, what, 4, 5?
Yeah, something like that.
So,
yeah, I think maybe what it did do is, I felt it was a bit of a stretch too. But it, in a way, it kind of added to, like, the wholesome vibe where they have this kind of mom and pop thing going on, you know. Maybe that's kind of what they were going for with the casting there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it could be.
But maybe they just shouldn't have had such small children, because, you know, I think young Charlie was, you know, that was fine. It was the two younger ones that kind mm-hmm. of made it a bit unbelievable. One thing I did like, though, so Henry Travers, who plays the father, and that relationship he's got going on, I mean, it's what you alluded to when I introduced you, you know, with Herb, mm-hmm. Hume Cronin's character. That was very amusing, I thought. You know, they're kind of talking all the while about how you'd kill each other and so on. So I thought if they're comic relief figures, that was very funny, I thought. Maybe some of the stuff with the little children was less amusing. But I suppose one of the questions would be, like, does that take away from the story? You know, did it need this comic relief? And did it work, in your opinion?
I think it worked. I think the film, while it didn't necessarily need it, it added something to the film, like I said, that I thought was really interesting. Because it's these side characters that are, while he's not essential to the plot, he becomes essential to the plot at the very end. You know, it establishes that he just shows up at unexpected times, you know, and although it is kind of the same time, I mean, I know I ate an hour ago, right? It's basically, he's probably coming at the same time, but it's interesting that he would just show up, and it gave reason and justification for him to just walk by and hear this. So it's a very interesting way to resolve how she doesn't die at the end with the poisoning, the gas poisoning.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, in terms of it as comedy, I don't think it takes away from the film at all, because what I think it does is, like, if you insert a figure like Uncle Charlie into this setting, it packs more punch because you've almost got a clash of genres going on, you know, because he's effectively, he's this kind of figure from a thriller or a film noir or something, and he's coming into this weird, like, domestic comedy almost. So that sense I get that you've got competing elements wrestling with each other here is what I like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really well woven in together as well, because, and I'm glad that they weren't talking about the search for the Merryweather killer the whole time, because I think that would have been too on the nose. So the fact that they only mention it at the end as a plot point for Uncle Charlie to get relaxed and decide to stay, I think was really well written. You know, because I wouldn't have liked it had these two characters kept mentioning the Merryweather killer over and over and over in their scenes as well. I don't think I would have liked that.
Yeah, I think you're right. It definitely could have been a bit excessive, couldn't it? Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree. I've seen this film compared to It's a Wonderful Life, actually. I take it you've seen It's a Wonderful Life, Brendan?
No, I haven't.
That's a film that, surprisingly, it's got this reputation as this feel-good classic, but within it, it's got some darkness that you don't necessarily expect, you know. And it's the same kind of collision. You get a vision sequence where you see the town, Bedford Falls. You see kind of like a dark side to it. You see kind of what could have happened. Well, what would have happened if James Stewart's character wasn't there? So again, you get a collision of like comedy with like almost film noir. The difference between them, I mean, I know you haven't seen it, but Capra's film, at the end, it leaves you with a tremendously powerful kind of feel-good feeling that most people are in tears or they find it really convincing or whatever. With Hitchcock's film, though, I don't know, because it's much more kind of unsettling, I think, because it ends with like the community kind of memorializing this killer, don't they? Who'd been in their midst and they don't know and so on. So I think Hitchcock's film poses a few interesting questions in that respect. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, like, it's weird how it ends, but it's also weird with how the investigators are talking directly with Charlie as well and the information that they give her.
Yeah.
You know, that's a little unbelievable. Because if they're investigating this guy, like, why would they tip off that information, right? But it is an interesting ending in that he is such heralded as such a community. He's like this honorable community citizen, you know, and he's a son of the community or whatever they said when at the funeral. But, yeah.
Yeah, let's think a bit more about those final few sequences then. Because I'll tell you something I've read as I've been reading around. I read a really interesting take on this. I mean, the way it looks is like it's an accidental death, doesn't it? You know, she isn't exactly culpable for it. He just kind of fell into the track of the other train. But there's another way of looking at it, which is this. I mean, let's see what you think, because I don't know if I necessarily subscribe to this myself, to be honest. But she says to him a bit earlier on, if you ever touch my mother again, I'll kill you, right? Mm-hmm. Then at the station, Uncle Charlie takes her mother's hand in his hand, you know, so he touches her again. Mm-hmm. That's followed by a shot of, like, young Charlie kind of staring at him, like, really intently. And it's in the background as that happens, that the behind her, the train kind of pulls up. So if you were, like, doing, like, a psychoanalytical reading of the film or something like that, you know, you could sort of say she's kind of willing this train into existence or something to kind of, like, get him out of the way. Do you know what I mean? But I'm not sure about this one.
No, so I wouldn't subscribe to this theory myself, because I didn't get that impression of any anger or hostility when she came on the train. And, you know, she would have maybe been more... had she gone on the train with the intention of killing him, you know, which I don't buy, then she wouldn't have wanted her brother and sister to get on the train with her, you know. And, like, I think she killed him in self-defense. That's my interpretation of the read. Like, she pushed him off at the end. That's my interpretation of the film. Because he's... this is the third time now that he's tried to kill her. So
I do like the take, though, because I thought it was interesting to read it and then to look at that scene again. I thought, oh, I can see what they're saying. Mm-hmm. I suppose it depends how much you want to suggest that, like, Hitchcock's working below the radar. Do you know what I mean? I suppose. But yeah, no, I think I'm with you. I mean, that last scene, though, it's something that's quite powerful, is this feeling that, like, Charlie's kind of lost her innocence, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's wondering now about how you get such monstrous people in the world. So it's like, you know, it's good that Uncle Charlie's gone, but, like, at the same time, some of her kind of illusions have been shattered, you know, some of the preconceptions she had are now gone. And that's a very sad thing, I think, you know, considering how, you know, how nice a figure she was, for want of a better word, you know?
Well, it's almost that final influence of Uncle Charlie, right? Like, yeah. if they're such paralleled characters, well, now she's, her view is now approaching his of the world as well, right? Like, seeing this dark underbelly that he keeps talking about.
I suppose if you follow that theory we were just going through, that she's kind of complicit in some way in his death, or she's kind of willed it into being or something, that kind of plays into it too, I suppose, if you wanted to go down that route. I was thinking about something you said actually earlier, which is that this didn't feel like a Hitchcock film to you. And I can see what you mean, I think. What did you mean? Do you mean because of the absence of, like, familiar Hitchcock tropes? Is that kind of what you meant?
Or? Yes. Like certain things that you would kind of expect out of Hitchcock. And I don't know how to quite put my thumb on it. Like, it just didn't quite feel like a Hitchcock film. Like, almost in the same way that The Wrong Man doesn't quite feel like a Hitchcock film. Like, it's different. It's something different that he's stretching his legs with a bit. But, I mean, Rebecca doesn't really feel like a Hitchcock film either, you know? Like, and these are classics of his, so I don't know. Like, it's just different from what I've been watching, but it's a masterpiece nonetheless. But one of the things, like, I got that kind of contributed to this as well is I think he got some direct influence from Orson Welles when he was creating this film. How familiar are you with Citizen Kane?
I've seen Citizen Kane a few times, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so Citizen Kane was, I believe, the first film, because on the DVD version that I have, they made a lot of stink about this, not stink, sorry, like a lot of focus about this during the bonus features, with the low camera angles looking up and being able to see the ceilings of the sets on Citizen Kane. And he did that in this film. Now, this is a couple of years after Citizen Kane, right? So I almost think, like, he saw Citizen Kane and is like, I got to use that. But there's a scene when Uncle Charlie is, like, walking around a room and the camera's basically sitting on the floor looking up at him, and you could see the ceilings there, right? So I got some Orson Welles feel from this, and I think Citizen Kane may have influenced Hitchcock in the direction of this film.
Yeah, well, you've got the cast in the Joseph Cotton as well, of course,
yeah,
who's in
yes.
Kane.
Yeah.
In terms of what you were saying about, you know, it doesn't feel like a Hitchcock film, one thing it does that's kind of different to a lot of Hitchcock films is, you know, in a lot of them we get an innocent man on the run. And it's almost an inversion here, isn't it? Because it's a guilty man, you know, on the run. But you do get that sense, don't you, that there's this other character off somewhere that we never see. This suspect in the East that they talk about, that they keep, the detectives are keeping an eye on. He's almost like the star of a Hitchcock film that's going on off screen, if you see what I mean. Because he's an innocent figure. He didn't commit the Merry Widow murders.
Right. We need that film. We need to launch a Kickstarter to make that film right now.
It's interesting. They both meet like a grisly end, though, because they talk about him being chopped down by a propeller.
Yeah.
And Charlie, of course, falls into the track of the train.
You know, I exactly thought of that, too. Like, as soon as he did that, I'm like, wow, that's just about as bad as the other guy's death, eh? But I also thought of certain things too, like when that happened, I wonder if this might have been like an influence a little bit for Spielberg for Raiders of the Lost Ark with how that one Nazi dies, right? Like by going into the propeller.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like is Spielberg's influenced by these kinds of films as well, right? But
that's
I don't know.
Yeah. What else in terms of Hitchcock themes? I mean, we talked about the doubling, but another thing that I didn't notice until it was pointed out to me, until I read it, was that Hitchcock's very meticulous here with doubling up other things too. So we get two scenes in a church, we get two scenes in the garage, two visits from the police, and two scenes set during mealtime. So there's a nice like rhyming going on there that maybe we don't pick up on like a conscious level, but it probably works on us kind of unconsciously, I guess.
I did not notice those things, no.
Yeah. Try and remember it for your next viewing in 10 years' time, or whatever it is.
Well, not that far away.
No. What about, like, staircases, then? I mean, that's one thing that jumped out at me when I was thinking of Hitchcock films, is I can think of quite a few examples of staircases being used. So I think of, like, the detective falling down the stairs in Psycho. I think there's some scenes, memorable stuff on the staircase in Notorious.
Some of his early silent films have a lot of staircase symbology as well, yep.
I'm not really sure exactly what the appeal of it was to him, but here you get a good scene, don't you, where Uncle Charlie kind of realizes that, hey, he's got off the hook for the crime, but young Charlie's going to continue to, like, blight, you know, kind of to dog him, I suppose.
I thought it was interesting that he kept trying to kill her and, like, wouldn't have just gone on his own way, because he doesn't seem like the kind of person who would be satisfied living in a town like this. So for him to decide to stay seems weird. He seems like the kind of guy that would be better suited in a big city life, you know?
Brandon, did you have anything else you wanted to bring up about this film before we move on to, like, listener feedback?
No, I think I've mentioned it all. One of the one things that I really wanted to mention was definitely that influence that I saw from Orson Welles in Citizen Kane. But I'm really glad that I got to see this again. I really enjoyed this film. And it really was like, wow, I can't believe I didn't remember a thing about this movie. Because even as other movies that I don't know that well, there's elements of them that I remember that really stand out. Where it's like, oh yeah, that's the movie that has this in it, that's the movie that has that in it. But this one, I'm like, I don't even know what this movie is.
Yeah, definitely. If anyone's got this far on the podcast, and I'm sure there probably isn't anyone in this situation who's kind of on the fence about whether or not to actually go and watch this film, I think we'd definitely recommend it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it'd be great to hear what people think about, like, the incest suggestion and stuff like that. Because I get the sense there might be a polarizing take on it, but I don't know. I mean, nobody mentioned it actually in the feedback I got on Twitter when I tweeted that I was watching this. Did anyone have any thoughts on the film? And a few people came back to me. So Marlene said, you asked me a while back about my other favorite Hitchcock's after Rear Window. Shadow of a Doubt is on that list, but I've seen it only once. And yeah, what she's referring to there, Brandon, I was tweeting about this a couple of weeks ago. I got to see Rear Window on the big screen, mm-hmm. which was great. And I was kind of talking to people about that at the time. So there's one person at least who ranks it amongst her favourite Hitchcocks. Let's see what other people thought. Erica D said, there are so many good things about Shadow of a Doubt. The setting of Santa Rosa is very quaint, yet big enough to allow Uncle Charlie to remain under the radar. So I guess that kind of goes back a little to what we were saying about the size of the town. Joseph Cotton is perfectly scheming as Uncle C, but I still like him better as a nice guy. Henry Travers, !! So she liked him. Teresa Wright was a splendid actress. Her chemistry with MacDonald Carey is terrific, and they make such a nice couple. The little sister is a bit annoying, and the parents seem too old to have kids so young. It's not my fave Hitchcock film, but it's great. So yeah, I guess that kind of tracks with a lot of what we said, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. People seem to have the same kind of takes as us.
Yeah. So G. Bliss said, I love Joseph Cotton's comment that he was in Hitchcock's favourite Hitchcock film, Orson Welles' best film in Citizen Kane, and Carol Reed's best film in The Third Man. Pretty damn impressive. So yeah, we talked about the ambiguous nature of, like, whether this is Hitchcock's favorite film or not. I get the sense it's one of those things that depending on who asked him on what day, you know, he must have said it at one point because people keep saying it to me. But yeah, no, it's a nice little lineup of films, isn't it, there for Cotton? So that's very impressive indeed.
Have you seen all three of those? Oh, you said you've seen Citizen Kane. You've seen Third Man as well.
I've seen The Third Man. Yeah. Have you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great yes, stuff. I spent many a sleepless night trying to get that zither music out of my head.
All right. A couple more before we go. Andy Wolverton said, well, actually, what he gave me a couple of links to stuff he'd written about the film, which was nice. So he's got a blog called Journeys in Darkness and Light. Journeysindarknessandlight.wordpress.com is where you find it. And a couple of quotes I pulled out. This was one of the films that helped define what we think of when we think of Hitchcock. Not only close-ups of faces filled with terror, offsetting tilted camera angles and the significance of shadows, but also, especially in the case of this film, the concept of danger appearing in a place or a person we had come to believe was safe and harmless. And that's a great take, I think, because immediately when I read that, what I thought of was like the bathroom in Psycho, you know, where a bathroom is a place where you should be safe, but if you're kind of assailed there or assaulted or whatever, mm-hmm. you're also very vulnerable. So I guess the home is the thing here, isn't it? If you've got the family home, which
and the uncle,
yeah, family member,
the family member.
So yeah, I really like that take on it, to be honest.
Well, if this guy's saying this is quintessential, setting us up for what we know of Hitchcock, then I've clearly just have to go and write my resignation letter for my podcast later on, because clearly I don't know what I'm talking about. To say that I don't think this feels like a Hitchcock film.
I was wondering if you were thinking of, like, because this film doesn't have the big set pieces or anything, or the prolonged, I mean, there's some suspense, mm-hmm. but maybe it's not the kind of iconic stuff we think of in other films. I wonder if that's part of it, you know?
I think you hit it on the head when it's like, it's the reverse.
Yeah.
With the guilty man on the run rather than the innocent man on the run. I think that's it right there, because that's such a common trope in his films. But, I mean, Rope is like that, too, and Rope is my favorite. The two main characters in Rope are guilty, you know? So, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about. You should probably delete this podcast, get another guest on here.
Well, let's see. Andy said something else, which is good, too. So, The quiet town of Santa Rosa could stand in for most American towns of the era, containing a timelessness, but also an innocent facade that covers some underlying nastiness. Shadow of a Doubt always reminds me of Blue Velvet. What a great double feature that would make.
Yeah, like that woman who worked at the Telegraph place, like, her response to that is, like, just one of disgust. Like, I don't know what I'm talking about. I just send letters. You know, and it's like, whoa, lady, just calm down there.
I'll tell you, I mean, I really have no idea what you'd make of Blue Velvet.
Mm-hmm. I love Lynch.
When I saw that for the first time, I was just, like, riveted to my seat, and it just kind of hit me on such a... It really got under my skin, it really did. But it's definitely an interesting comparison. And just finally, from Gabriella, she hadn't seen the film, but she got in touch with a few of her other favourite Hitchcock films. So let's just see what you think of this list. So she said... Psycho, of course, North by Northwest, Rope, Rebecca, based on her favourite novel, Notorious, and Spellbound. Oh, and Dial M for Murder. Ray Milland is awesomely devious. So yeah, when you put them one after another, it's a pretty good list, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's hard, because he's got so many great films, it's hard to rank. It's like ranking Fincher. You know, Fincher is probably my favourite director, and it's like hard to rank him, because you're sitting at position 8, and like, that's where I want to put Panic Room, but I'm like, that movie's a 6 out of 5, you know, like Panic Room's amazing, but you know, it's just when you're comparing those kind of lists, you know, it's hard. There's not many stinkers on that list.
What I just mentioned is Gabriella's been a good supporter of the podcast, and she's got her own blog she just recently started where she's writing about old movies and stuff. I think it's palewriter2.blogspot.com, I think. Anyway, check her out. I think it's @noir_or_never is her Twitter handle. So go there and find the blog from there if that link I gave out was wrong. But it's really good stuff. Like, we did an episode on the podcast, Brandon, myself and Darren Mooney, about Gilda. And we talked about, like, there's this implied gay relationship in the film. And then Gabriella went away and wrote a really great blog that kind of extended on what we said, you know. So it was really, really nice. I got one final question for you, Brandon, I guess. Put you on the spot. I mean, I should just explain that you get teased a bit, don't you, in the X-Files community for like some of your eccentric opinions. I think it's grossly unfair because we need independent thinkers, basically. And I get the sense you get a bit of, like, you know, good-natured teasing for it. And I think it's probably the same in the Star Trek fandom, perhaps, as well. But the question is, are there any, like, Hitchcock films that you're not as fond of as other people that kind of spring to mind?
Oh, geez, that I don't think are so good.
Yeah, I've got one. That's why I'm asking, because I've got one.
The Manxman was one that he completely dismissed. And we ended up having an amazing discussion on this film. And we loved it. We thought it was great. You know, same with Easy Virtue. Like, while that went down lower on my list, it's just because other things have, like, pushed it out of the way as being better. You know, I don't know. It's been interesting. I don't think there's any Hitchcock films that I'm just like, yeah, that's not that great. I guess, you know what, I got to say, probably maybe Rebecca. Like, it's... You know, because Rebecca feels so much like a Gone with the Wind or something like that, you know, that, you know, and The Wrong Man, I didn't really like The Wrong Man either, you know. So I guess those are kind of the two that I think are pretty well regarded that I'd say are not that high on my list myself.
Well, I've got a big one that people love, and I like it. I do like it.
I'm hovering my mouse over the hang up button right now just in case.
The film I'm thinking of is The Birds. All right,
what?
I've never been able to get get on board with The Birds fully. I'm going to dangle that there. I'm going to leave that for another day because I think that could make a nice podcast in its own right. But I'm not slamming The Birds. I just want to make that clear before people press unsubscribe on iTunes or whatever. I just when I saw that Shadow of Doubt was ahead of The Birds on IMDb, I was like, oh, good. I'm glad because it is better than The Birds, in my opinion.
Well, if you want to change your opinion and think that The Birds is a good movie, watch The Birds 2, and then you'll realize just how much better The Birds is than Birds 2.
All right, Brandon, it's been an absolute pleasure. Really enjoyed talking to you about this one. Where can people find you? I mean, Good Evening Pod, of course, will be the one, you know, we want to get the contact info for that. But, I mean, I know you've got many irons in the podcasting fire, haven't you? So whatever you want to draw people's attention to, go for it.
You bet. Actually, the list is shorter if I tell you where you can't find me. But yes, over on the Fandom Podcast Network, and we have our own independent feed, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. That's with my friends Chris and Tom. You can find me over on Trek FM with two podcasts. One is called Melodic Treks, which is all about the music of Star Trek, and one's called Warp 5, which is all about Star Trek Enterprise. And we're wrapping up right now. We're just wrapping up over on the Talk Film Society. My friend Zach Moore and I are doing an 11-episode retrospective on the Halloween films. So depending on when this episode drops, they're dropping on Tuesdays, and our last episode on the new film will drop the Tuesday after the new film comes out. So that's been a lot of fun, and we've had some really great discussions talking about the Michael Myers films. But yeah, Twitter at Brandon Mattel is the best place to find me.
Great stuff. Thank you, Brandon. And as for the Movie Palace, you can find us at the usual places. So it's Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, Facebook.com/Movie Palace Pod, or just type Movie Palace in the search box there. You should find us. I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. I'm in a band podcast.
I've been pretty ill, like in Holland. Just Will got sick in Holland one time and I got it first and I was feeling really rough on stage.
As you always do.
I just had to try and do my best. I don't always get, I'm not this sickly little tiny Tim you make me out to be. I'm not. I'm not tiny Tim.
Sorry, carry on your story. Just a passing comment, sorry.
That's it, really. That was it. I was just saying that, like, you know, sometimes you just gotta pretend.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Colin, so they come out of the 3 million years and everyone's dead. I don't know if you wear this, Colin. Everyone's dead, Colin.
Yes.
Everyone's dead, Colin.
What, Peterson?
They're dead. They're dead.
Everybody's dead, Colin.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
It's a recurring thing for quite some time, and I must admit, as much as I actually love, you know, comedy in general, that I love repetitive comedy.
Yes.
And you speak about The Simpsons, I love it when Sideshow Bob hits those rakes.
Yeah.
He's just going,
yeah.
And he does that for ages. And this is another kind of aspect to that.
Between the Notes.
And then when he left in The Dark Knight Rises, I think it's no coincidence that I found Dark Knight Rises like just an ear-batteringly loud movie in terms of its music.
Right, well, this is where I rise up.
So you've come to save your city.
all the impressions are coming out.
It has to be done, Sean. It has to be done. Maybe you should present what piece of music you have here.
So you're lucky I didn't do the entire podcast as Bane. I'm still doing impressions of Bane 8 years later.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.